Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is recuperating at home from a cracked pelvis. She hopes to be back on the air next week. Nancy Rappaport was only 4 years old when her mother committed suicide in 1963. Now a child psychiatrist, Rappaport set out to understand who her mother really was and why she took her own life. She joins me in the studio to discuss her new memoir. It's titled In Her Wake. A child psychiatrist explores the mystery of her mother's suicide. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We're going to invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or you can always send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. So you were just 4 when this tragic event happened. How was her death explained to you when you were young?
There weren't a lot of words put to it. I think I just had a sense that she had left me, and I was the youngest of 6. My oldest sister was 11 at the time, so there was a 11, 10, 9, 7, 6, and 4-year-olds. And I think one of the ways that our family coped, my father had remarried at the time, and so we actually had 9 children in the family, was to encourage us to go on.
So a kind of pact of silence.
Oftentimes suicide is talked about as silent grief, and that it's so hard. It took me 15 years to write this book, so it's hard to put words to a loss that has such a complicated reaction to it.
Your older siblings, I'm sure, have clearer memories of
Absolutely.
Your mother than you do. What memories do you have of her?
I really only have a few memories, although now, having done the kind of research I have, I sort of created them in my mind. So thank God for imagination. But I had a vivid memory of being on an airplane and the tarmac and the sun shining down and her hand being on my shoulder. But I don't know where I'm going. I think it's a vacation. It's hot out. But that's the clear memory I have. But over the years, I also came to appreciate that there's such a sense of drive for me to know who my mother is. And I truly believe that she loved all of us deeply. And I think that came across, even though it wasn't a memory I have of her telling me that.
You say it took you 15 years to write this book. Why did you decide you wanted to write it?
Well, the book started out that when my oldest daughter Lila was born, I was in birth, and I actually had this rush of understanding in labor that my mother must have profoundly loved me, because I had this baby coming into my arms. And then about a week later, a friend of my mother's had found me somewhere. I'd never really talked to anyone who knew my mother, and she came to give me a bracelet that had belonged to my mother and tell me some stories. And I started to write down everything she said. And then I put it away for about probably 5 or 6 years. I didn't really write much. I was busy having babies. I have 3 teenagers right now. And then after my youngest, Zoe, turned 4 years old, which is when my mother died for me, I think I knew I'm going to make it as a mother. I'm going to survive. And then I really wanted my mother to know who I was. So I would wake up in the middle of the night and I would write her, they were called letters to Mama. Of course, one of my kids said, well, who are you sending it to? But it was writing to her, and I wanted her to know who I was. And as a child psychiatrist, as a mother, but it wasn't a book. It was letters to her. And then I shared them with some friends. They said, these are okay. Maybe you want to do something with them. So that was the beginning of an evolution. And then over the 10-year period, people always say, is this therapeutic for you? And I think the first 5 years it was cathartic. And then it really became, I want the reader to know how much I care about my mother. And I want them to know when someone kills themselves, they think they're expendable. And they think it won't really matter if I'm not in this world. And I am trying to, resurrect is too much of a religious word, but I'm trying to say someone is loved deeply and they will be missed. So that's the quality of when I went to then try to write a good book, it was to say, I want the reader to feel my search and it to be a psychological suspense. I don't want to torture them. I want them to read it as if it's a page turner and it's a detective novel, but it's a detective novel with a tragic end, except that they have a narrator that is alive and well and fiercely passionate about taking care of kids.
You talk about it as a mystery, as a detective story, and you went about researching your mother as a detective might. What kinds of things did you do to find out about her?
Oh, boy, what didn't I do? So let me just give you one was a surprise, and that was that after I'd been writing these letters to Mama for, several years, into an abyss, sort of, who are you, what are you? I had gotten a call from my stepmother, and she had a trunk, and in the trunk were all sorts of things that my mother's best friend had kept for 40 years. And so I went from having almost nothing of my mother to having high school report cards, yearbooks, letters from the kids, and a novel that she'd been writing at the time of her death.
So a novel that seemed to have a protagonist very much like her.
I think of it as a semi-autobiographical. The name of her novel is End of Freedom, and it's you're right. It's a story that the main character ends up killing herself.
You managed to find some newspaper accounts of her, and in fact, the cover of the book is a picture that ran in a Boston newspaper about her. Why were there newspaper stories about her?
Well, both my mother and my father have a prominence in Boston. My mother came from a political family, an Irish political family. My father's been a developer and philanthropic. So there's been interest in my family, and there had been a difficult custody battle that had ensued and had captured at the time in 1961 the interest of newspaper. So there were articles that were on microfilm that were available.
Now, you said that when you were growing up, there was a sort of pact of silence in your family about talking about your mother. And I wonder how your father and your siblings felt when they heard that you were going to write this book. Now, at first, you started to work on the book without telling them.
Yes, which I'm really glad I did, because I think that it's very difficult if you're a writer, particularly an emerging writer, to have a level of critique that's going on in the back of your mind. And I needed to have the privacy to figure out what did I feel myself before I shared it with my family. But also, that's a part of this story. My family was remarkably generous about me revisiting a very painful time that happened. Think of this. I am 49 years old right now, soon to be 50. And I'm talking about something that happened 45 years ago. And I'm asking my father to revisit that time, or my siblings to think about a time that they may have moved on from. So I hope that the story is also about how do you have sometimes difficult conversations that can give you remarkable insight and compassion about your family members.
One of your sisters said that you were just stuck in the past.
Yeah.
What did you say to her?
I think she still thinks I'm stuck in the past. I think all of us have different ways of grieving, and we need to honor that. But a question, just to give you an example, with my dad, I asked him, and it was a question I never would have asked him at 4 years old, but I said, did you visit my mother when she was, before she died, after she'd taken the massive overdose, she was in a coma. And I said, did you visit my mother in the hospital? And he said, yes. And I said, well, you know, what did you say to her? And he said, I would take care of our children. And my father did do that. He took care of 13 children. But that to have that kind of conversation with people you love or my older sister, Martha, you know, we had never been so close. And then when I talked with her about her, I had never realized that my mother killed herself 3 days before her 11th birthday, and what that must have meant, being a mother now, knowing to lose your mom. So there was a quality of emerging closeness that came from having these kinds of very powerful, sometimes scary discussions.
Is it possible, though, for anyone in your family to have moved on from this suicide without having had these kind of conversations or exploration about it? Is it possible to do that?
Absolutely. I think there's the tyranny of therapy, which is that this idea that that everybody has to talk about their losses in order to be able to metabolize them. Someone might go on a long hike. They might have a close friend. They might go to a support group. So I am not going to elevate myself in terms of being the family member that's, you know, metabolized it in the best way, even though we tend to have a fairly competitive family, and I might like to do that. I don't think this is a necessary path. It was my path to coming to some kind of resolution.
And you decided not just to write this book, report out and write this book, but to share it, to publish it, to let everyone who wanted to buy a copy read it.
That's a good point. I think there would have been some people who might have been relieved if I just did this as a cathartic experience and put it into a desk buried somewhere. But I knew that this was a story that needed to be told, and if it saved one person's life, I was satisfied with that.
We're talking to Nancy Rappaport about her new book, In Her Wake. A child psychiatrist explores the mystery of her mother's suicide. We'll take a short break and then we'll be back. You can call our toll-free line, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page with USA Today, and with me in the studio is Nancy Rappaport. She's an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. She is attending child and adolescent psychiatry consultant to the Cambridge Public Schools and director of the school-based programs in child psychiatry at the Cambridge Health Alliance. But she's with us today to talk about her very personal book, In Her Wake, A Child Psychiatrist Explores the Mystery of her mother's suicide. In just a few minutes, we'll go to the phones and take your calls, and we'll read some of your emails. You can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. So you set out to do this book to find out who your mother was, the mother you never really knew. So what did you conclude at the end of it? Who was Nancy Rappaport, your mother?
Right. She was a bright, vivacious lady who, I think, was tortured at the end of her life and really didn't see that what seemed impossible for her to imagine. She was in a custody battle, and I think she truly believed she'd never get her children back at the moment that she killed herself. And I think that that's true when people are in a deep depression, that they believe that whatever problem they're confronting is permanent. And I also think she was creative, a caring mother, and that I absorbed things about her that I never knew until I did some of the research. She was an advocate for children. She loved purple. I love purple. I read that in her book. And she was she got a master's in English, which I didn't know. I never knew that she did that. When you read in the book, there's a whole passage about psychological testing that was tucked in the trunk, and in it, it talks about that she had no common sense. And anybody who knows me would know that I have no common sense. But there's aspects of a quality about her that I hope comes across in the book of a very vital person. And that adds to the tragedy of the loss.
Very active in the community, chairman of the United Fund, supervising thousands of people as a volunteer. But what happened in the period just leading up to her death that made her feel so desperate?
Well, she had made a suicide attempt 2 years before, and I think that's what prompted her to write the novel. And she was in a custody battle with my father and had thought that she had turned it around. And on the day that she killed herself, the situation had gone to the Massachusetts Supreme Court. And so she was supposed to be getting back her kids, but it was stayed, meaning that it was going to be revisited. So I think that was part of why it's so important for me to have done this story, because I think when suicide happens, it's very easy to blame the people that are surviving. And suicide's a tragedy. It's so important for people when they're healing to understand that blaming other people is not helpful.
She was just 34 years old. Now, was there a time when you worried that you were somehow responsible?
Absolutely. 4 years old is a perfect age to feel responsible. You, as a child psychiatrist, I can say this, you are the center of your universe. And anything that happens, is an airplane flying, you made it happen. So I was prime target. I mean, suicide makes many survivors of suicide feel guilty. But a four-year-old, it's a perfect developmental stage to feel guilty. And not in a verbal way, but in a bone marrow way.
That somehow you could have prevented it, perhaps.
I mean, even though, of course, the listeners will say, that's magical thinking, but that's what you can carry with you.
This is one of the issues you worked out when you saw a therapist yourself as an adolescent. What did he tell you?
He was a remarkably compassionate therapist who, first of all, which I hope I can do with my patients, he listened to me. And he listened to me recount a dream that I'd had, a terrifying dream that had been an over and over kind of recurrent dream, where I thought that I had come into the bedroom and seen my mother with a bottle of pills open, and then had just sort of walked away without saving her.
And now, had that actually happened?
No, I wasn't around when it happened. She was in another location. But he was able to both hear the kind of pain that would, you know, the terror, I mean, of what that would mean, and then try to reassure me that I wasn't responsible.
You were seeing this Dr. Walter, but your father then stopped paying for the therapy. Why did he do that?
Well, that was a little complicated. And it's not as relevant to this story, but it was more around his frustration that my stepmother, Barbara, that I wanted to live with her.
And so he stopped paying for it, but you managed to continue seeing Dr. Walter. How did you do that?
I'm an extremely persistent, semi-resilient person, not to be self-promoting. So I did a lot of babysitting and had a card business that I made pictures, and the therapist dropped the price so it wasn't as expensive, and I kept going.
Now, one of the things you discovered in doing work in looking to who your mother was and what had happened with her was you found that she had been pregnant at the time of her death.
Yeah, that's one of the more brutal aspects. She was 4 months pregnant when she had the overdose. So you could say I was the youngest, maybe. And that was, she was had remarried to Alex Stanley, and I had tracked down his niece and talked with him.
You write in the book about whether your mother might have been influenced in taking this step by the suicide of Marilyn Monroe the year before, by the suicide of Sylvia Plath earlier that year in 1963. Do you think they played a part in the step that she took?
That's speculative. I mean, one of the hard things is sometimes people will say to me, you know, when they hear about my book, they'll say, well, was your mother mentally ill? And, you know, I didn't interview her. I'm trying to go from all different aspects. So I'm looking at the possibility that Marilyn Monroe and various, and she was an English major, so that she might have been impacted by that. But I don't know.
Here's an email from Keith, who's writing us from Silver Spring, Maryland. He says, I'm having a difficult time with this. How sure are you that your mother would want all of this out in the open? Does her privacy count?
Thank you, Keith. That's a wonderful question. And both of us will never know. I hope that in my book that I've honored her. And you'll have to find out when you read it whether that's the case.
Let's talk to Carl. He's calling us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Carl, thank you so much for calling us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you for taking my call. And I was just wondering if you had ever thought about finishing and publishing your mother's novel.
Again, another wonderful question. I read her book very, very closely, and I wish she had stayed alive to do some editing on it. It's a long book. It's about 400 pages, and it has some sort of extraneous, complicated political developments, because in her main character is running for governor, and I got lost in some of the details. So, you know, if people wanted to, I guess we could think about that being a companion piece, but it didn't. There were many. Chapter 3 is all about her novel, and I take out pieces that I thought were relevant. But I'm sure someone else might read her novel and say there's a whole other aspect of it. For instance, when I talked with my sister Martha, she talked about the aspects of the politics being fascinating to her because she had been in politics herself. And so the way that my mother talked about cataloging contacts and what had happened was, and the so. It's an open piece.
Carl, thanks for your call. Let's go to Keith. He's calling us from Rochester, New York. Keith, you're on the air.
Yes, believe it or not, this upcoming Christmas Day will be the 40th year of my mother's passing. She was a suicide down in Kentucky after the family activities of Christmas Eve had died down. She killed herself during the night, and we found her hanging in the far corner of their master bedroom. Two points I want to bring up. My mother had made at least several other attempts to do herself in. It has to be said that pointedly. Mm-hmm. And I think very sadly, and I'm just going to make a blanket statement, since so many people have a hard time dealing with death, that when someone is really intent on taking their own life, they shall do so. My mother had gone out several times into the woods to do herself in, and she was brought back. And even factoring in that we know 4 decades later a lot more than we did back then, things are going to happen, and people just have to understand that. Plus, I also have to mention that my father is a clergyman, and I was very angry at him. 2 years after my mother's death, I threw back at him that here he was, a man of the cloth. He couldn't even keep his own wife alive. I said to him, where else in southeastern Kentucky would you have had the sight of two Kentucky State Police trooper cars at opposite ends of the property? I said to him, here you are, a man of God, and our family that's lost our mother and your wife, and I could not understand that he, being a pastor, that it was our family. In other words, normal families, me being an MK, a minister's kid, we were supposed to be, in my mind, the outstanding ones, and yet we had lost our family member.
Yeah.
And I really think this all comes together, and it's closing, tragic that in your case 63 and mine 6 years after that it goes on and on and on, and the point you made earlier that it's the living who have to 10 with us, and the one who's taken their life is long gone. That is, of course, the unstated a mystery out of all this, that when someone kills himself, you never can go back to them and say why. You stated you are needed, but you did yourself in, and it goes on and on. And
right, Keith. Well, thank you so much. You know, even 40 years later, that's just such a tragic story about your mother. We're sorry for your loss.
So, Keith, I agree in terms of being sorry about it. But the other parts that I want to build on is that definitely suicide attempts make someone vulnerable to a completed suicide, and it's why it's so important to get treatment after a suicide attempt. And I believe passionately that what we want to be able to do is have discussions with people who are suicidal, that it's not a terminal illness. You're right that we may lose the very determined to suicide, but I have the privilege of working with teenagers who may be suicidal and coming in on the side of their ambivalence. If someone's talking to you, chances are that they're trying to find another answer. And my work as a professional is to work with people to say there are other options and to treat major depression. When you're suicidal, there are times when that's a signal probably that there's a major depression going on.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. And yet someone like Keith was a child when his mother committed suicide, when she had made suicide attempts before. What could a child do you think, if they're worried about a parent or about a sibling, that they might be feeling this desperate?
I've certainly worked with kids who've been in Keith's situation where something horrible has happened to their parent, or they're worried. And one thing I would say is that they need to go to a trusted adult and share that information, so that I think they should never worry alone.
And what about a spouse? Say a spouse is worried that their husband or wife is suicidal or might be suicidal. What should they do?
Well, hopefully they would ask their partner, are you feeling so desperate that you want to kill yourself? And then if they get an answer of yes, saying, let's try to figure out together how to get you help.
We have an email from Elizabeth, and she says, my husband committed suicide 5 months ago. My son is 7 and doesn't know how his father died. What should I tell him and when? Thank you from a survivor.
Well, my heart goes out to you. I would say, first of all, I'm not so sure your son doesn't know. In my book, I have a composition that I've written, which is Franny's Trial with Love, when I was in fourth grade. And when I went back to read it as a child psychiatrist, I knew a lot more about what was going on than probably a lot of adults knew. So I would encourage you, and certainly if you needed help, there's assistance in finding the right words. I often work with parents to think about a way that's tolerable to the parent. But I think that it's important to be honest with our kids and to help them find words about what happened to their parent.
And so even at 7, as Elizabeth's son is, he should understand that his father took his own life?
I would encourage that. And I think many people in the field would say, you don't want to overwhelm them with details, so you may not talk about all the way. You might say, you know, you're thinking about for a 7-year-old, because it's different for each age group, 7 versus 14. But you might say words such as, you know, your father was in terrible pain and he died by suicide, and we're all very sad about this, and we're here for you and each other while we try to understand this.
You talked how even at age 4 you felt somehow were you responsible, and I wonder, is that also part of talking to a child to say this was not your fault?
Absolutely, and to be explicit about it. And that's a primary reason why you want to be able to talk about it, because the child's going to be left with unanswered questions. You may think they don't know about it, but they were playing in the basement while the adults were talking about it. Kids learn by osmosis, and I would really encourage if she could to to find the words.
Do you think it was this experience that you had when you were so young that influenced you to go into child psychiatry yourself?
I thought I was going to be a pediatrician working in Harlem, and I did pediatrics, and I found myself always migrating towards talking with kids and families about how they felt. So child psychiatry has been a wonderful profession for me, both probably motivated by some level of having worked through my own sorrow, that I can sit with kids, and without saying anything, they may know that I've had my own things that have happened to them.
In your book, you write, "As a doctor, I was no longer a powerless four-year-old. I was sure I could do something to make things better." We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Nancy Rappaport about her new book, In Her Wake. We'll take some of your calls and read some emails. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by NPR stations, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org, and by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as Animal Week continues, Temple Grandin explains how her experiences as an autistic person have helped her understand animals. And Michael Schaefer, author of One Nation Under Dog, talks about pet ownership in an era of doggy Prozac, dog park politics, organic pet food, and pet health insurance. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio, Nancy Rappaport, a child psychiatrist. She's written a new book, In Her Wake, a child psychiatrist explores the mystery of her mother's suicide. We've been taking some callers. Let's go to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and talk to Christy. Christy, thanks for calling.
Hi. My question is, did you have to work to forgive your father for instigating this child custody battle? I went through one myself, and it was devastating to think I might lose my child.
All right. Thanks for your call, Christy.
So my mother wrote in her papers that no mother can imagine what it means to be separated from her children. So I know that, you know, custody battles can be brutal, and that it can be destabilizing to think that you can lose your children.
Let's talk to Todd. He's calling us from Kings Mountain, North Carolina. Todd, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. And Dr. Rappaport, thank you for writing your book, because I think it's a very important message. I am myself a psychiatrist, an adult and forensic psychiatrist, and have four children, 9, 11, 11, and 13, and through a divorce and really missing my children, my X and I are both very dedicated to them. I used to believe suicide was a very selfish thing. And still in many ways see it in that way, but you're blinded, and at my practice was failing, the divorce, and I'd never really considered suicide, but I was failing so much as a father, and my big goal was to provide for my family, and I just realized how much I had in life insurance, and realized I could, you know, wrap my car around a tree, and that'd make everything okay. At least that's what my mind told me for a minute, but thank God I'm a psychiatrist and know that that's just my depression or self-pity lying to me, and that, you know, I mean much more to my kids as a father than you know, millions would ever mean to them, and that it's not, you know, it doesn't make things better in any way, shape, or form. That's a message that I really believe we need to get out to everyone, mm-hmm. because having gone through, you know, the most difficult time in my life, I know that in those times, your mind can tell you all sorts of stuff. And thank God I had people to call to say, hey, this is what I'm thinking about. What do you think about it? And they said, I don't think that's a real good idea.
So they did exactly what Nancy Rappaport said you ought to do if you hear about someone who's thinking about suicide. Todd, thank you so much for calling and sharing that story.
Well, I'm glad you're alive. And I think you're also highlighting, though, that physicians do sometimes end up killing themselves and that they have a higher rate than the average suicide rate, and how important it is for self-care if you're in a helping profession.
Now, there was a point where your own daughter asked you if you were going to commit suicide. Was that because she knew about your mom?
Yes. She was asking it in the context of that, and I reassured her that I have absolutely no intention of, and she was very young at the time. She was 8 years old.
And yet the children...
Whoops, I just want to make sure the listeners know I have absolutely no intent in killing myself.
Well, that's good to hear. But it is true that the child of a parent who's committed suicide is 5 times more likely to kill himself or herself than a child who has not been exposed to that kind of loss. Why is that?
Well, it's a complicated statistic to unpack, because what happens is it can be that within that statistic of those people who tragically end up killing themselves, there might be a high level of impulsivity in the children, a mental illness that's present, and substance abuse. So my sense about what you take with that message is not that having a parent kill themselves is a death sentence for you, because that would be certainly not the message I'd want to communicate, but it's the message that you have a certain vulnerability. And you need to, just as if you get in a car and you drive, you want to put a seatbelt on, that you want to be vigilant about self-care and recognizing depression if it happens, not drinking overly. And that's what I'd say.
I wonder, you have siblings who went through the same experience that you did with your mother committing suicide. Have you talked to them about this?
Yeah, that's chapter 5. But I spent a summer talking with each of them and asking them about what their experience was like.
You have a strong sense of what this meant to you, what impact your mother's suicide had on you. What is your sense of what impact it had on your siblings?
You know, that's the remarkable piece. There's 5 other siblings, so each of them had different reactions, both in terms of their sense of loyalty to both my mother and my father, and in terms of the kinds of things that they remembered. So one of my brothers is very clear that she probably had bipolar disorder, and that he remembers her being up in the middle of the night frantically baking cookies, and that's his take on it, and that there wasn't good treatment at that time, and now there is. One of my other sisters feels like, you know what, she was bereft at not having her children with her, and that's why she did it. So it becomes sort of a whole cacophony isn't the right word, but it's a chorus of different ways that people are looking at her life and trying to come to some understanding of what happened.
And do you feel that one of you is right and the others are wrong, or are they all pieces of a puzzle?
The answer died with my mother. So I'm doing my best to understand what happened to her. And I respect how each one of us has tried to come to some understanding. And I know from being a psychiatrist that the most important thing is building a narrative, building a story, coming to some kind of understanding. And then that's what we've all done.
Do you feel that you've done this, succeeded in doing that for yourself?
Absolutely. I am, you know, it's always a little bit awkward and people